place to make the best decisions about this. Wouldn't it be nice, for instance, to know exactly how much we would enjoy a new home, a new car, a different sofa, and an Armani suit, so that we could make accurate decisions about owning them? Unfortunately, this is rarely the case. We are mostly fumbling around in the dark. Why? Because of three irrational quirks in our human nature. The first quirk, as we saw in the case of the basketball tickets, is that we fall in love with what we already have. Suppose you decide to sell your old VW bus. What do you start doing? Even before you've put a for sale sign in the window, you begin to recall trips you took. You were much younger, of course. The kids hadn't sprouted into teenagers. A warm glow of remembrance washes over you and the car. This applies not only to VW buses, of course, but to everything else. And it can happen fast. For instance, two of my friends adopted a child from China and told me this remarkable story. They went to China with 12 other couples. When they reached the orphanage, the director took each of the couples separately into a room and presented them with a daughter. When the couples reconvened the following morning, they all commented on the director's wisdom. Somehow she knew exactly which little girl to give to each couple. The matches were perfect. My friends felt the same way, but they also realized that the matches had been random. What made each match seem perfect was not the Chinese woman's talent, but nature's ability to make us instantly attached to what we have. The second quirk is that we focus on what we may lose rather than what we may gain. When we price our beloved VW, therefore, we think more about what we will lose, the use of the bus, than what we will gain, money to buy something else. Likewise, the ticket holder focuses on losing the basketball experience, rather than imagining the enjoyment of obtaining money, or on what can be purchased with it. Our aversion to loss is a strong emotion, and as I will explain later in the book, one that sometimes causes us to make bad decisions. Do you wonder why we often refuse to sell some of our cherished clutter, and if somebody offers to buy it, we attach an exorbitant price tag to it? As soon as we begin thinking about giving up our valued possessions, we are already mourning the loss. The third quirk is that we assume other people will see the transaction from the same perspective as we do. We somehow expect the buyer of our VW to share our feelings, emotions, and memories. Or we expect the buyer of our house to appreciate how the sunlight filters through the kitchen windows. Unfortunately, the buyer of the VW is more likely to notice the puff of smoke that is emitted as you shift from first into second. And the buyer of your house is more likely to notice the strip of black mold in the corner. It is just difficult for us to imagine that the person on the other side of the transaction, buyer or seller, is not seeing the world as we see it. Ownership also has what I'd call peculiarities. For one, the more work you put into something, the more ownership you begin to feel for it. Think about the last time you assembled some furniture. Figuring out which piece goes where and which screw fits into which hole boosts the feeling of ownership. In fact, I can say with a fair amount of certainty that pride of ownership is inversely proportional to the ease at which one assembles the furniture, wires the high-density television to the surround sound system, installs software, or gets the baby into the bath, dried, powdered, diapered, and tucked away in the crib. My friend and colleague Mike Norton, a professor at Harvard, and I have a term for this phenomenon, the IKEA effect. Another peculiarity is that we can begin to feel ownership even before we own something. Think about the last time you entered an online auction. Suppose you make your first bid on Monday morning for a wristwatch, and at this point you are the highest bidder. That night you log on, and you're still the top dog. Ditto for the next night. You start thinking about that elegant watch. You imagine it on your wrist. You imagine the compliments you'll get. And then you go online again 1 hour before the end of the auction. Some dog has topped your bid. Someone else will take your watch. So you increase your bid beyond what you had originally planned. Is the feeling of partial ownership causing the upward spiral we often see in online auctions? Is it the case that the longer an auction continues, the greater grip virtual ownership will have on the various bidders and the more money they will spend? A few years ago, James Heyman, Yesim Orhan, a professor at the University of Chicago, and I set up an experiment to explore how the duration of an auction gradually affects the auction's participants and encourages them to bid to the bitter end. As we suspected, the participants who were the highest bidders for the longest periods of time ended up with the strongest feelings of virtual ownership. Of course, they were in a vulnerable position. Once they thought of themselves as owners, they were compelled to prevent losing their position by bidding higher and higher. Virtual ownership, of course, is one of the mainsprings of the advertising industry. We see a happy couple driving down the California coastline in a BMW convertible, and we imagine ourselves there. We get a catalogue of hiking clothing from Patagonia and see a polyester fleece pullover, and poof, we start thinking of it as ours. The trap is set, and we willingly walk in. We become partial owners even before we own anything. There's another way that we can get drawn into ownership. Often, companies will have trial promotions. If we have a basic cable television package, for instance, we are lured into a digital gold package by a special trial rate, only $59 a month instead of the usual $89. After all, we tell ourselves, we can always go back to basic cable or downgrade to the silver package. But once we try the gold package, of course, we claim ownership of it. Will we really have the strength to downgrade to basic or even to digital silver again? Doubtful. At the onset, we may think that we can easily return to the basic service, but once we are comfortable with the digital picture, we begin to incorporate our ownership of it into our view of the world and ourselves and quickly rationalize away the additional price. More than that, our aversion to loss, the loss of that nice, crisp, gold package picture and the extra channels, is too much for us to bear. In other words, before we make the switch, we may not be certain that the cost of the digital gold package is worth the full price, but once we have it, the emotions of ownership come welling up to tell us that the loss of digital gold is more painful than spending a few more dollars a month. We may think we can turn back, but that is actually much harder than we expected. Another example of the same hook is the 30-day money-back guarantee. If we are not sure whether or not we should get a new sofa, the guarantee of being able to change our mind later may push us over the hump so that we end up getting it. We fail to appreciate how our perspective will shift once we have it at home, and how we will start viewing the sofa as ours, and consequently start viewing returning it as a loss. We might think we are taking it home only to try it out for a few days, but in fact we are becoming owners of it, and are unaware of the emotions the sofa can ignite in us. Ownership is not limited to material things. It can also apply to points of view. Once we take ownership of an idea, whether it's about politics or sports, what do? We love it, perhaps, more than we should. We prize it more than it is worth. And most frequently, we have trouble letting go of it because we can't stand the idea of its loss. What are we left with then? An ideology, rigid and unyielding. There is no known cure for the ills of ownership. As Adam Smith said, it is woven into our lives. But being aware of it might help. Everywhere around us we see the temptation to improve the quality of our lives by buying a larger home, a second car, a new dishwasher, a lawnmower, and so on. But once we change our possessions, we have a very hard time going back down. As I noted earlier, ownership simply changes our perspective. Suddenly, moving backward to a pre-ownership state is a loss, one that we cannot abide. And so, while moving up in life, we indulge ourselves with the fantasy that we can always ratchet ourselves back if need be. In reality, we can't. Downgrading to a smaller home, for instance, is experienced as a loss. It is psychologically painful, and we are willing to make all kinds of sacrifices in order to avoid such losses, even if, in this case, the monthly mortgage sinks our ship. My own approach is to try to view all transactions, particularly large ones, as if I were a non-owner, putting some distance between myself and the item of interest. In this attempt, I am not certain if I have achieved the uninterest in material things that is espoused by the Hindu sannyasi, but at least I try to be as zen as I can about it. Chapter 8. Keeping Doors Open. Why Options Distract Us from Our Main Objective. In 210 BC, a Chinese commander named Sheng Yu led his troops across the Yangtze River to attack the army of the Qin dynasty. Pausing on the banks of the river for the night, his troops awakened in the morning to find to their horror that their ships were burning. They hurried to their feet to fight off their attackers, but soon discovered that it was Sheng Yu himself who had set their ships on fire, and that he had also ordered all the cooking pots crushed. Sheng Yu explained to his troops that without the pots and the ships, they had no other choice but to fight their way to victory or perish. That did not earn Sheng Yu a place on the Chinese army's list of favorite commanders, but it did have a tremendous focusing effect on his troops. Grabbing their lances and bows, they charged ferociously against the enemy and won 9 consecutive battles, completely obliterating the main force units of the Qin dynasty. Sheng Yu's story is remarkable because it is completely antithetical to normal human behavior. Normally, we cannot stand the idea of closing the doors on our alternatives. Had most of us been in Sheng Yu's armor, in other words, we would have sent out part of our army to tend to the ships, just in case we needed them for retreat, and we would have asked others to cook meals, just in case the army needed to stay put for a few weeks. Still others would have been instructed to pound rice out into paper scrolls, just in case we needed parchment on which to sign the terms of the surrender of the mighty Qin, which was highly unlikely in the first place. In the context of today's world, we work just as feverishly to keep all our options open. We buy the expandable computer system, just in case we need all those high-tech bells and whistles. We buy the insurance policies that are offered with the plasma high-definition television, just in case the big screen goes blank. We keep our children in every activity we can imagine, just in case one sparks their interest in gymnastics, piano, French, organic gardening, or taekwondo. And we buy a luxury SUV, not because we really expect to drive off the highway, but because, just in case we do, we want to have some clearance beneath our axles. We might not always be aware of it, but in every case we give something up for those options. We end up with a computer that has more functions than we need, or a stereo with an unnecessarily expensive warranty. And in the case of our kids, we give up their time and ours, and the chance that they could become really good at one activity, in trying to give them some experience in a large range of activities. In running back and forth among the things that might be important, we forget to spend enough time on what really is important. It's a fool's game, and one that we are remarkably adept at playing. I saw this precise problem in one of my undergraduate students, an extremely talented young man named Joe. As an incoming junior, Joe had just completed his required courses, and now he had to choose a major. But which one? He had a passion for architecture. He spent his weekends studying the eclectically designed buildings around Boston. He could see himself as a designer of such proud structures one day. At the same time, he liked computer science, particularly the freedom and flexibility that the field offered. He could see himself with a good-paying job at an exciting company like Google. His parents wanted him to become a computer scientist. And besides, who goes to MIT to be an architect anyway? The architecture department at MIT is, in fact, very good. Still, his love of architecture was strong. As Joe spoke, he wrung his hands in frustration. The classes he needed for majors in computer science and architecture were incompatible. For computer science, he needed algorithms, artificial intelligence, computer systems engineering, circuits and electronics, signals and systems, computational structures, and a laboratory in software engineering. For architecture, he needed different courses. Experiencing Architecture Studio, Foundations in the Visual Arts, Introduction to Building Technology, Introduction to Design Computing, Introduction to the History and Theory of Architecture, and a further set of architecture studios. How could he shut the door on one career or the other? If he started taking classes in computer science, he would have a hard time switching over to architecture. And if he started in architecture, he would have an equally difficult time switching to computer science. On the other hand, if he signed up for classes in both disciplines, he would most likely end up without a degree in either field at the end of his 4 years at MIT, and he would require another year, paid for by his parents, to complete his degree. He eventually graduated with a degree in computer science, but he found the perfect blend in his first job, designing nuclear subs for the Navy. Dana, another student of mine, had a similar problem, but hers centered on two boyfriends. She could dedicate her energy and passion to a person she had met recently, and she hoped build an enduring relationship with him, or she could continue to put time and effort into a previous relationship that was by now dying. She clearly liked the new boyfriend better than the former one, yet she couldn't let the earlier relationship go. Meanwhile, her new boyfriend was getting restless. "Do you really want to risk losing the boy you love," I asked her, "for the remote possibility that you may discover at some later date that you love your former boyfriend more?" She shook her head no, and broke into tears. I'm often surprised by how much people confide in me. I think it's partly due to my scars, and to the obvious fact that I've been through substantial trauma. On the other hand, what I would like to believe is that people simply recognize my unique insight into the human psyche, and thus seek my advice. Either way, I learn a lot from the stories people share with me. What is it about options that is so difficult for us? Why do we feel compelled to keep as many doors open as possible, even at great expense? Why can't we simply commit ourselves? Matrimony is a social device that would seem to force individuals to shut down their alternative options, but as we know, it too doesn't always work. To try to answer these questions, Ji Wong Shin, a professor at Yale, and I devised a series of experiments that we hoped would capture the dilemma represented by Joe and Dana. In our case, the experiment would be based on a computer game that we hoped would eliminate some of the complexities of life and would give us a straightforward answer about whether people have a tendency to keep doors open for too long. We called it the door game. For a location, we chose a dark, dismal place, a cavern that even Sheng Yu's army would have been reluctant to enter. MIT's East Campus Dormitory is a daunting place. It is home to the hackers, hardware enthusiasts, oddballs, and general misfits. And believe me, it takes a serious misfit to be a misfit at MIT. One hall allows loud music, wild parties, and even public nudity. Another is a magnet for engineering students, whose models of everything from bridges to roller coasters can be found everywhere. If you ever visit this hall, press the Emergency Pizza button, and a short time later, a pizza will be delivered to you. A third hall is painted completely black. A fourth has bathrooms adorned with murals of various kinds. Press the palm tree, or the samba dancer, and music, piped in from the hall's music server, all downloaded legally, of course, comes on. One afternoon a few years ago, Kim, one of my research assistants, roamed the hallways of East Campus with a laptop tucked under her arm. At each door, she asked the students whether they'd like to make some money participating in a quick experiment. When the reply was in the affirmative, Kim entered the room and found, sometimes only with difficulty, an empty spot to place the laptop. As the program booted up, three doors appeared on the computer screen, one red, the second blue, and the third green. Kim explained that the participants could enter any of the three rooms, red, blue, or green, simply by clicking on the corresponding door. Once they were in a room, each subsequent click would earn them a certain amount of money. If a particular room offered between 1 cent and 10 cents, for instance, they would make something in that range each time they clicked their mouse in that room. The screen tallied their earnings as they went along. Getting the most money out of this experiment involved finding the room with the biggest payoff and clicking in it as many times as possible. But this wasn't trivial. Each time you moved from one room to another, you used up one click. You had a total of 100 clicks. On one hand, switching from one room to another might be a good strategy for finding the biggest payout. On the other hand, running madly from door to door and room to room meant that you were burning up clicks, which could otherwise have made you money. Albert, a violin player and a resident of the Dark Lord Crotus Worshippers' Hall, was one of the first participants. He was a competitive type and determined to make more money than anyone else playing the game. For his first move, he chose the red door and entered the cube-shaped room. Once inside, he clicked the mouse. It registered 3.5 cents. He clicked again, 4.1 cents. A third click registered 1 cent. After he sampled a few more of the rewards in this room, his interest shifted to the green door. He clicked the mouse eagerly and went in. Here, he was rewarded with 3.7 cents for his first click. He clicked again and received 5.8 cents. He received 6.5 cents the third time. At the bottom of the screen, his earnings began to grow. The green room seemed better than the red room, but what about the blue room? He clicked to go through that last, unexplored door. Three clicks fell in the range of 4 cents. Forget it. He hurried back to the green door, the room paying about 5 cents a click, and spent the remainder of his 100 clicks there, increasing his payoff. At the end, Albert inquired about his score. Kim smiled as she told him it was one of the best so far. Albert had confirmed something that we suspected about human behavior. Given a simple setup and a clear goal, in this case to make money, all of us are quite adept at pursuing the source of our satisfaction. If you were to express this experiment in terms of dating, Albert had essentially sampled one date, tried another, and even had a fling with a third. But after he had tried the rest, he went back to the best, and that's where he stayed for the remainder of the game. But to be frank, Albert had it pretty easy. Even while he was running around with other dates, the previous ones waited patiently for him to return to their arms. But suppose that the other dates, after a period of neglect, began to turn their backs on him. Suppose that his options began to close down. Would Albert let them go, or would he try to hang on to all his options for as long as possible? In fact, would he sacrifice some of his guaranteed payoffs for the privilege of keeping these other options alive? To find out, we changed the game. This time, any door left unvisited for 12 clicks would disappear forever. Sam, a resident of the Hackers' Hall, was our first participant in the disappearing condition. He chose the blue door to begin with, and after entering it, he clicked 3 times. His earnings began building at the bottom of the screen, but this wasn't the only activity that caught his eye. With each additional click, the other doors diminished by 1/12. Signifying that if not attended to, they would vanish. 8 more clicks, and they would disappear forever. Sam wasn't about to let that happen. Swinging his cursor around, he clicked on the red door, brought it up to its full size, and clicked 3 times inside the red room. But now he noticed the green door. It was 4 clicks from disappearing. Once again, he moved his cursor, this time restoring the green door to its full size. The green door appeared to be delivering the highest payout. So should he stay there? Remember that each room had a range of payouts, so Sam could not be completely convinced that the green door was actually the best. The blue might have been better, or perhaps the red, or maybe neither. With a frenzied look in his eye, Sam swung his cursor across the screen. He clicked the red door and watched the blue door continue to shrink. After a few clicks in the red, he jumped over to the blue. But by now the green was beginning to get dangerously small, and so he was back there next. Before long, Sam was racing from one option to another, his body leaning tensely into the game. In my mind, I pictured a typically harried parent rushing kids from one activity to the next. Is this an efficient way to live our lives, especially when another door or two is added every week? I can't tell you the answer for certain in terms of your personal life, but in our experiments, we saw clearly that running from pillar to post was not only stressful, but uneconomical. In fact, in their frenzy to keep doors from shutting, our participants ended up making substantially less money, about 15% less, than the participants who didn't have to deal with closing doors. The truth is that they could have made more money by picking a room, any room, and merely staying there for the whole experiment. Think about that in terms of your life or career. When Ji Wong and I tilted the experiments against keeping options open, the results were still the same. For instance, we made each click opening a door cost 3 cents, so that the cost was not just the loss of a click, an opportunity cost, but also a direct financial loss. There was no difference in response from our participants. They still had the same irrational excitement about keeping their options open. Then we told the participants the exact monetary outcomes they could expect from each room. The results were still the same. They still could not stand to see a door close. Also, we allowed some participants to experience hundreds of practice trials before the actual experiment. Certainly, we thought they would see the wisdom of not pursuing the closing doors. But we were wrong. Once they saw their options shrinking, our MIT students, supposedly among the best and brightest of young people, could not stay focused. Pecking like barnyard hens at every door, they sought to make more money and ended up making far less. In the end, we tried another sort of experiment, one that smacked of reincarnation. In this condition, a door would still disappear if it was not visited within 12 clicks. But it wasn't gone forever. Rather, a single click could bring it back to life. In other words, you could neglect a door without any loss. Would this keep our participants from clicking on it anyhow? No. To our surprise, they continued to waste their clicks on the reincarnating door, even though its disappearance had no real consequence and could always be easily reversed. They just couldn't tolerate the idea of the loss, and so they did whatever was necessary to prevent their doors from closing. How can we unshackle ourselves from this irrational impulse to chase worthless options? In 1941, the philosopher Erich Fromm wrote a book called Escape from Freedom. In a modern democracy, he said, people are beset not by a lack of opportunity, but by a dizzying abundance of it. In our modern society, this is emphatically so. We are continually reminded that we can do anything and be anything we want to be. The problem is in living up to this dream. We must develop ourselves in every way possible, must taste every aspect of life, must make sure that of the 1,000 things to see before dying, we have not stopped at number 999. But then comes a problem. Are we spreading ourselves too thin? The temptation Fromm was describing, I believe, is what we saw as we watched our participants racing from one door to another. Running from door to door is a strange enough human activity, but even stranger is our compulsion to chase after doors of little worth, opportunities that are nearly dead or that hold little interest for us. My student Dana, for instance, had already concluded that one of her suitors was most likely a lost cause. Then why did she jeopardize her relationship with the other man by continuing to nourish the wilting relationship with the less appealing romantic partner? Similarly, how many times have we bought something on sale, not because we really needed it, but because by the end of the sale, all those items would be gone, and we could never have it at that price again? The other side of this tragedy develops when we fail to realize that some things really are disappearing doors and need our immediate attention. We may work more hours at our jobs, for instance, without realizing that the childhood of our sons and daughters is slipping away. Sometimes these doors close too slowly for us to see them vanishing. One of my friends told me, for instance, that the single best year of his marriage was when he was living in New York, his wife was living in Boston, and they met only on weekends. Before they had this arrangement, when they lived together in Boston, they would spend their weekends catching up on work rather than enjoying each other. But once the arrangement changed, and they knew that they had only the weekends together, their shared time became limited and had a clear end, the time of the return train. Since it was clear that the clock was ticking, they dedicated the weekends to enjoying each other rather than doing their work. I'm not advocating giving up work and staying home for the sake of spending all your time with your children, or moving to a different city just to improve your weekends with your spouse, although it might provide some benefits. But wouldn't it be nice to have a built-in alarm to warn us when the doors are closing on our most important options? So what can we do? In our experiments, we proved that running helter-skelter to keep doors from closing is a fool's game. It will not only wear out our emotions, but also wear out our wallets. What we need is to consciously start closing some of our doors. Small doors, of course, are rather easy to close. We can easily strike names off our holiday card lists, or omit the Taekwondo from our daughter's string of activities. But the bigger doors, or those that seem bigger, are harder to close. Doors that just might lead to a new career or to a better job might be hard to close. Doors that are tied to our dreams are also hard to close. So are relationships with certain people, even if they seem to be going nowhere. We have an irrational compulsion to keep doors open. It's just the way we're wired. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to close them. Think about a fictional episode. Rhett Butler leaving Scarlett O'Hara and Gone with the Wind. The scene when Scarlett clings to him and begs him, "Where shall I go? What shall I do?" Rhett, after enduring too much from Scarlett and finally having his fill of it, says, "Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn." It's not by chance that this line has been voted the most memorable in cinematographic history. It's the emphatic closing of a door that gives it widespread appeal. And it should be a reminder to all of us that we have doors, little and big ones, which we ought to shut. We need to drop out of committees that are a waste of our time and stop sending holiday cards to people who have moved on to other lives and friends. We need to determine whether we really have time to watch basketball and play both golf and squash and keep our family together. Perhaps we should put some of these sports behind us. We ought to shut them, because they draw energy and commitment away from the doors that should be left open, and because they drive us crazy. Suppose you've closed so many of your doors that you have just two left. I wish I could say that your choices are easier now, but often they are not. In fact, choosing between two things that are similarly attractive is one of the most difficult decisions we can make. This is a situation not just of keeping options open for too long, but of being indecisive to the point of paying for our indecision in the end. Let me use the following story to explain. A hungry donkey approaches a barn one day looking for hay, and discovers two haystacks of identical size at the two opposite sides of the barn. The donkey stands in the middle of the barn between the two haystacks, not knowing which to select. Hours go by, but he still can't make up his mind. Unable to decide, the donkey eventually dies of starvation. This story is hypothetical, of course, and casts unfair aspersions on the intelligence of donkeys. A better example might be the U.S. Congress. Congress frequently gridlocks itself, not necessarily with regard to the big picture of particular legislation, the restoration of the nation's aging highways, immigration, improving federal protection of endangered species, etc., but with regard to the details. Often, to a reasonable person, the party lines on these issues are the equivalent of the two bales of hay. Despite this, or because of it, Congress is frequently left stuck in the middle. Wouldn't a quick decision have been better for everybody? Here's another example. One of my friends spent 3 months selecting a digital camera from two nearly identical models. When he finally made his selection, I asked him how many photo opportunities had he missed, how much of his valuable time he had spent making the selection, and how much he would have paid to have digital pictures of his family and friends documenting the last 3 months. "More than the price of the camera," he said. Has something like this ever happened to you? What my friend, and also the donkey and Congress, failed to do when focusing on the similarities and minor differences between two things was to take into account the consequences of not deciding. The donkey failed to consider starving. Congress failed to consider the lives lost while it debated highway legislation. And my friend failed to consider all the great pictures he was missing, not to mention the time he was spending at Best Buy. More important, they all failed to take into consideration the relatively minor differences that would have come with either one of the decisions. My friend would have been equally happy with either camera. The donkey could have eaten either bale of hay, and the members of Congress could have gone home crowing over their accomplishments, regardless of the slight difference in bills. In other words, they all should have considered the decision an easy one. They could have even flipped a coin, figuratively, in the case of the donkey, and gotten on with their lives. But we don't act that way, because we just can't close those doors. Although choosing between two very similar options should be simple, in fact, it is not. I fell victim to this very same problem a few years ago, when I was considering whether to stay at MIT or move to Stanford. I chose MIT in the end. Confronted with these two options, I spent several weeks comparing the two schools closely and found that they were about the same in their overall attractiveness to me. So what did I do? At this stage of my problem, I decided I needed some more information and research on the ground. So I visited both schools. I met people at each place and asked them how they liked it. I checked out neighborhoods and possible schools for our kids. Sumi and I pondered how the two options would fit in with the kind of life we wanted for ourselves. Before long, I was getting so engrossed in this decision that my academic research and productivity began to suffer. Ironically, as I searched for the best place to do my work, my research was being neglected. Since you have probably invested some money to purchase my wisdom in this book, not to mention time, and the other activities you've given up in the process, I should probably not readily admit that I wound up like the donkey, trying to discriminate between two very similar bales of hay. But I did. In the end, and with all my foreknowledge of the difficulty in this decision-making process, I was just as predictably irrational as everyone else. Chapter 9. The Effect of Expectations. Why the Mind Gets What It Expects. Suppose you're a fan of the Philadelphia Eagles, and you're watching a football game with a friend who sadly grew up in New York City and is a rabid fan of the Giants. You don't really understand why you ever became friends, but after spending a semester in the same dorm room, you start liking him, even though you think he's football challenged. The Eagles have possession and are down by 5 points with no timeouts left. It's the fourth quarter, and 6 seconds are left on the clock. The ball is on the 12-yard line. 4 wide receivers line up for the final play. The quarterback hikes the ball and drops back in the pocket. As the receivers sprint toward the end zone, the quarterback throws a high pass just as the time runs out. An Eagles wide receiver near the corner of the end zone dives for the ball and makes a spectacular catch. The referee signals a touchdown, and all the Eagles players run onto the field in celebration. But wait. Did the receiver get both of his feet in? It looks close on the jumbotron. So the booth calls down for a review. You turn to your friend. Look at that! What a great catch! He was totally in! Why are they even reviewing it? Your friend scowls. That was completely out. I can't believe the ref didn't see it. You must be crazy to think that was in. What just happened? Was your friend, the Giants fan, just experiencing wishful thinking? Was he deceiving himself? Worse, was he lying? Or had his loyalty to his team, and his anticipation of its win, completely, truly, and deeply clouded his judgment? I was thinking about that one evening, as I strolled through Cambridge and over to MIT's Walker Memorial Building. How could two friends, two honest guys, see one soaring pass in two different ways? In fact, how could any two parties look at precisely the same event and interpret it as supporting their opposing points of view? How could Democrats and Republicans look at a single schoolchild who is unable to read and take such bitterly different positions on the same issue? How could a couple embroiled in a fight see the causes of their argument so differently? A friend of mine who had spent time in Belfast, Ireland, as a foreign correspondent, once described a meeting he had arranged with members of the IRA. During the interview, news came that the governor of the Mays Prison, a winding row of cell blocks that held many IRA operatives, had been assassinated. The IRA members standing around my friend, quite understandably, received the news with satisfaction, as a victory for their cause. The British, of course, didn't see it in those terms at all. The headlines in London the next day boiled with anger and calls for retribution. In fact, the British saw the event as proof that discussions with the IRA would lead nowhere and that the IRA should be crushed. I am an Israeli and no stranger to such cycles of violence. Violence is not rare. It happens so frequently that we rarely stop to ask ourselves why. Why does it happen? Is it an outcome of history, or race, or politics? Or is there something fundamentally irrational in us that encourages conflict, that causes us to look at the same event and, depending on our point of view, see it in totally different terms? Leonard Lee, a professor at Columbia, Shane Frederick, a professor at MIT, and I didn't have any answers to these profound questions. But in a search for the root of this human condition, we decided to set up a series of simple experiments to explore how previously held impressions can cloud our point of view. We came up with a simple test, one in which we would not use religion, politics, or even sports as the indicator. We would use glasses of beer. You reach the entrance to Walker by climbing a set of broad steps between towering Greek columns. Once inside, and after turning right, you enter two rooms with carpeting that predates the advent of electric light, furniture to match, and a smell that has the unmistakable promise of alcohol, packs of peanuts, and good company. Welcome to the Muddy Charles, one of MIT's two pubs, and a location for a set of studies that Leonard, Shane, and I would be conducting over the following weeks. The purpose of our experiments would be to determine whether people's expectations influence their views of subsequent events. More specifically, whether bar patrons' expectations for a certain kind of beer would shape their perception of its taste. Let me explain this further. One of the beers that would be served to the patrons of the Muddy Charles would be Budweiser. The second would be what we fondly called MIT Brew. What's MIT Brew? Basically, Budweiser, plus a secret ingredient. 2 drops of balsamic vinegar for each ounce of beer. Some of the MIT students objected to our calling Budweiser beer, so in subsequent studies we used Sam Adams, a substance more readily acknowledged by Bostonians as beer. At about 7 that evening, Jeffrey, a second-year PhD student in computer science, was lucky enough to drop by the Muddy Charles. "Can I offer you 2 small free samples of beer?" asked Leonard, approaching him. Without much hesitation, Jeffrey agreed, and Leonard led him over to a table that held 2 pitchers of the foamy stuff, one labelled A and the other B. Jeffrey sampled a mouthful of one of them, swishing it around thoughtfully, and then sampled the other. "Which one would you like a large glass of?" asked Leonard. Jeffrey thought it over. With a free glass in the offing, he wanted to be sure he would be spending his near future with the right malty friend. Jeffrey chose beer B as the clear winner, and joined his friends, who were in deep conversation over the cannon that a group of MIT students had recently borrowed from the Caltech campus. Unbeknownst to Jeffrey, the 2 beers he had previewed were Budweiser and the MIT Brew, and the one he selected was the vinegar-laced MIT Brew. A few minutes later, Mina, a visiting student from Estonia, dropped in. "Like a free beer?" asked Leonard. Her reply was a smile and a nod of the head. This time Leonard offered more information. Beer A, he explained, was a standard commercial beer, whereas beer B had been doctored with a few drops of balsamic vinegar. Mina tasted the 2 beers. After finishing the samples, and wrinkling her nose at the vinegar-laced brew B, she gave the nod to beer A. Leonard poured her a large glass of the commercial brew, and Mina happily joined her friends at the pub. Mina and Jeffrey were only 2 of hundreds of students who participated in this experiment. But their reaction was typical. Without foreknowledge about the vinegar, most of them chose the vinegary MIT brew. But when they knew in advance that the MIT brew had been laced with balsamic vinegar, their reaction was completely different. At the first taste of the adulterated suds, they wrinkled their noses and requested the standard Budweiser instead. The moral, as you might expect, is that if you tell people up front that something might be distasteful, the odds are good that they will end up agreeing with you. Not because their experience tells them so, but because of their expectations. If, at this point in the book, you are considering the establishment of a new brewing company, especially one that specializes in adding some balsamic vinegar to beer, consider the following points. 1. If people read the label or knew about the ingredient, they would most likely hate your beer. 2. Balsamic vinegar is actually pretty expensive, so even if it makes beer taste better, it may not be worth the investment. Just brew a better beer instead. Beer was just the start of our experiments. The MBA students at MIT's Sloan School also drink a lot of coffee. So one week, Elie Ofek, a professor at the Harvard Business School, Marco Bertini, a professor at the London Business School, and I opened an impromptu coffee shop, at which we offered students a free cup of coffee if they would answer a few questions about our brew. A line quickly formed. We handed our participants their cups of coffee, and then pointed them to a table set with coffee additives. Milk, cream, half and half, white sugar, and brown sugar. We also set out some unusual condiments. Cloves, nutmeg, orange peel, anise, sweet paprika, and cardamom, for our coffee drinkers to add to their cups as they pleased. After adding what they wanted, and none of our odd condiments was ever used, and tasting the coffee, the participants filled out a survey form. They indicated how much they liked the coffee, whether they would like it served in the cafeteria in the future, and the maximum price they would be willing to pay for this particular brew. We kept handing out coffee for the next few days, but from time to time we changed the containers in which the odd condiments were displayed. Sometimes we placed them in beautiful glass and metal containers, set on a brushed metal tray with small silver spoons and nicely printed labels. At other times we placed the same odd condiments in white styrofoam cups. The labels were handwritten in a red felt-tip pen. We went further, and not only cut the styrofoam cups shorter, but gave them jagged, hand-cut edges. What were the results? No, the fancy containers didn't persuade any of the coffee drinkers to add the odd condiments. I guess we won't be seeing sweet paprika in coffee any time soon. But the interesting thing was that when the odd condiments were offered in the fancy containers, the coffee drinkers were much more likely to tell us that they liked the coffee a lot, that they would be willing to pay well for it, and that they would recommend that we should start serving this new blend in the cafeteria. When the coffee ambience looked upscale, in other words, the coffee tasted upscale as well. When we believe beforehand that something will be good, therefore it generally will be good. And when we think it will be bad, it will be bad. But how deep are these influences? Do they just change our beliefs, or do they also change the physiology of the experience itself? In other words, can previous knowledge actually modify the neural activity underlying the taste itself, so that when we expect something to taste good or bad, it will actually taste that way? To test this possibility, Leonard, Shane, and I conducted the beer experiments again, but with an important twist. We had already tested our MIT brew in two ways: by telling our participants about the presence of vinegar in the beer before they tasted the brew, and by not telling them anything at all about it. But suppose we initially didn't tell them about the vinegar, then had them taste the beer, then revealed the presence of the vinegar, and then asked for their reactions. Would the placement of the knowledge, coming just after the experience, evoke a different response from what we received when the participants got the knowledge before the experience? For a moment, let's switch from beer to another example. Suppose you heard that a particular sports car was fantastically exciting to drive, took one for a test drive, and then gave your impressions of the car. Would your impressions be different from those of people who didn't know anything about the sports car, took the test drive, then heard the car was hot, and then wrote down their impressions? In other words, does it matter if knowledge comes before or after the experience? And if so, which type of input is the more important? Knowledge before the experience, or an input of information after an experience has taken place? The significance of this question is that if knowledge merely informs us of a state of affairs, then it shouldn't matter whether our participants received the information before or after tasting the beer. In other words, if we told them up front that there was vinegar in the beer, This should affect their review of the beer. And if we told them afterward, that should similarly affect their review. After all, they both got the same bad news about the vinegar-laced beer. This is what we should expect if knowledge merely informs us. On the other hand, if telling our participants about the vinegar at the outset actually reshapes their sensory perceptions to align with this knowledge, then the participants who know about the vinegar up front should have a markedly different opinion of the beer from those who swigged a glass of it and then were told. Think of it this way. If knowledge actually modifies the taste, then the participants who consumed the beer before they got the news about the vinegar tasted the beer in the same way as those in the blind condition, who knew nothing about the vinegar. They learned about the vinegar only after their taste was established, at which point, if expectations change our experience, it was too late for the knowledge to affect the sensory perceptions. So did the students who were told about the vinegar after tasting the beer like it as little as the students who learned about the vinegar before tasting the beer? Or did they like it as much as the students who never learned about the vinegar? What do you think? As it turned out, the students who found out about the vinegar after drinking the beer liked the beer much better than those who were told about the vinegar up front. In fact, those who were told afterward about the vinegar liked the beer just as much as those who weren't aware that there was any vinegar in the beer at all. What does this suggest? Let me give you another example. Suppose Aunt Darcy is having a garage sale, trying to get rid of many things she collected during her long life. A car pulls up, some people get out, and before long, they are gathered around one of the oil paintings propped up against the wall. Yes, you agree with them. It does look like a fine example of early American primitivism. But do you tell them that Aunt Darcy copied it from a photograph just a few years earlier? My inclination, since I am an honest, upright person, would be to tell them. But should you tell them before or after they finish admiring the painting? According to our beer studies, you and Aunt Darcy would be better off keeping the information under wraps until after the examination. I'm not saying that this would entice the visitors to pay thousands of dollars for the painting, even though our beer drinkers preferred our vinegar-laced beer as much when they were told after drinking it as when they were not told at all. But it might get you a higher price for Aunt Darcy's work. By the way, we also tried a more extreme version of this experiment. We told one of two groups in advance about the vinegar, the before condition, and told the second group about the vinegar after they had finished the sampling, the after condition. Once the tasting was done, rather than offer them a large glass of their choice, we instead gave them a large cup of unadulterated beer, some vinegar, a dropper, and the recipe for the MIT brew, 2 drops of balsamic vinegar per ounce of beer. We wanted to see if people would freely add balsamic vinegar to their beer. If so, how much they would use, and how these outcomes would depend on whether the participants tasted the beer before or after knowing about the vinegar. What happened? Telling the participants about the vinegar after, rather than before, they tasted the beer doubled the number of participants who decided to add vinegar to their beer. For the participants in the after condition, the beer with vinegar didn't taste too bad the first time around, they apparently reasoned, and so they wouldn't mind giving it another try. We were also hoping to measure the amount of vinegar students added to the beer. But everyone who added vinegar added the exact amount specified in the recipe. As you see, expectations can influence nearly every aspect of our life. Imagine that you need to hire a caterer for your daughter's wedding. Josephine's Catering boasts about its delicious Asian-style ginger chicken and its flavorful Greek salad with Kalamata olives and feta cheese. Another caterer, Culinary Sensations, offers a succulent organic breast of chicken roasted to perfection and drizzled with a Merlot demi-glace, resting in a bed of herbed Israeli couscous, and a mélange of the freshest Roma cherry tomatoes and crisp field greens, paired with a warm circle of chèvre in a fruity raspberry vinaigrette. Although there is no way to know whether Culinary Sensations food is any better than Josephine's, the sheer depth of the description may lead us to expect greater things from the simple tomato and goat cheese salad. This, accordingly, increases the chance that we, and our guests, if we give them the description of the dish, will rave over it. This principle, so useful to caterers, is available to everyone. We can add small things that sound exotic and fashionable to our cooking. Chipotle mango sauces seem all the rage right now, or try buffalo instead of beef. These ingredients might not make the dish any better in a blind taste test, but by changing our expectations, they can effectively influence the taste when we have this pre-knowledge. These techniques are especially useful when you are inviting people for dinner or persuading children to try new dishes. By the same token, it might help the taste of the meal if you omit the fact that a certain cake is made from a commercial mix, or that you used generic rather than brand-name orange juice in a cocktail, or, especially for children, that Jell-O comes from cow hooves. I am not endorsing the morality of such actions, just pointing to the expected outcomes. Finally, don't underestimate the power of presentation. There's a reason that learning to present food artfully on the plate is as important in culinary school as learning to grill and fry. Even when you buy takeout, try removing the styrofoam packaging and placing the food on some nice dishes and garnishing it, especially if you have company. This can make all the difference. One more piece of advice. If you want to enhance the experience of your guests, invest in a nice set of wine glasses. Moreover, if you're really serious about your wine, you may want to go all out and purchase the glasses that are specific to Burgundies, Chardonnays, Champagne, etc. Each type of glass is supposed to provide the appropriate environment, which should bring out the best in these wines, even though controlled studies find that the shape of the glass makes no difference at all in an objective blind taste. That doesn't stop people from perceiving a significant difference when they are handed the correct glass. Moreover, if you forget that the shape of the glass really has no effect on the taste of the wine, you yourself may be able to better enjoy the wine you consume in the appropriately shaped fancy glasses. Expectations, of course, are not limited to food. When you invite people to a movie, you can increase their enjoyment by mentioning that it got great reviews. This is also essential for building the reputation of a brand or product. That's what marketing is all about. Providing information that will heighten someone's anticipated and real pleasure. But do expectations created by marketing really change our enjoyment? I'm sure you remember the famous Pepsi Challenge ads on television, or at least you may have heard of them. The ads consisted of people chosen at random, tasting Coke and Pepsi, and remarking about which they liked better. These ads, created by Pepsi, announced that people preferred Pepsi to Coke. At the same time, the ads for Coke proclaimed that people preferred Coke to Pepsi. How could that be? Were the two companies fudging their statistics? The answer is in the different ways the two companies evaluated their products. Coke's market research was said to be based on consumers' preferences when they could see what they were drinking, including the famous red trademark, while Pepsi ran its challenge using blind tasting and standard plastic cups marked M and Q. Could it be that Pepsi tasted better in a blind taste test, but that Coke tasted better in a non-blind, sighted test? To better understand the puzzle of Coke versus Pepsi, a terrific group of neuroscientists, Sam McClure, John Lee, Damon Tomlin, Kim Seipert, Latne Montague, and Reed Montague, conducted their own blind and non-blind taste test of Coke and Pepsi. The modern twist on this test was supplied by a functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, machine. With the machine, the researchers could monitor the activity of the participants' brains while they consumed the drinks. Tasting drinks while one is in an fMRI is not simple, by the way, because a person whose brain is being scanned must lie perfectly still. To overcome this problem, Sam and his colleagues put a long plastic tube into the mouth of each participant, and from a distance injected the appropriate drink, Pepsi or Coke, through the tube into their mouths. As the participants received a drink, they were also presented with visual information indicating either that Coke was coming, that Pepsi was coming, or that an unknown drink was coming. This way, the researchers could observe the brain activation of the participants while they consumed Coke and Pepsi, both when they knew which beverage they were drinking and when they did not. What were the results? In line with the Coke and Pepsi challenges, It turned out that the brain activation of the participants was different depending on whether the name of the drink was revealed or not. This is what happened. Whenever a person received a squirt of Coke or Pepsi, the center of the brain associated with strong feelings of emotional connection, called the ventromedial prefrontal